There's a man I think you've heard of. His name was Martin Luther King. Well, he wanted a world of peace and love. He said, I have a dream.
This is Murray Everson, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we're going to take a look at the Times Man of the Year, Martin Luther King Jr. This from January 3rd, 1964. As this story shows, it's in the words and context of its time. King became the symbol of a revolution in 1963, a pivotal year in the fight for equality. In 1963, the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, a coalition of conscience ineradicably changed the course of U.S. life. 19 million Negro citizens forced the nation to take stock of itself. It was the year of the Negro Revolution. Birmingham was its main battleground, and Martin Luther King Jr., the leader of the Negroes in Birmingham, became to millions the symbol of that revolution. King is, in many ways, the unlikely leader of an unlikely organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a loose alliance of 100 or so church-oriented groups. He earns no more money than some plumbers, $10,000 a year, and possesses little in the way of material things. King preaches endlessly about nonviolence, but his protest movements often lead to violence. He himself has been stabbed in the chest and physically attacked 3 more times. His home has been bombed 3 times, and he has been pitched into jail 14 times. His mail brings him a daily dosage of opinion in which he is by turn vilified and glorified. One letter says, in quotes, "This isn't a threat but a promise. Your head will be blown off as sure as Christ made green apples." But another ecstatically calls him, again in quotes, "a Moses sent to lead his people to the promised land of first-class citizenship." King has the capacity for empathy that is the touchstone of leadership. By deed and by preachment, he has stirred in his people a Christian forbearance that nourishes hope and smothers injustice, says Atlanta's Negro minister Ralph D. Abernathy, whom King calls his dearest friend and cellmate. The people make Dr. King great. He articulates the longings, the hopes, the aspirations of his people in a most earnest and profound manner. He is a humble man, down to earth, honest. He has proved his commitment to Judeo-Christian ideals. He seeks to save the nation and its soul, not just the Negro. Whatever his greatness, it was thrust upon him. King was born on January 15, 1929, at a time when the myth of the subhuman Negro flourished. King's maternal grandfather was one of Georgia's first NAACP leaders. His preacher father was in the forefront of civil rights battles aimed at securing equal salaries for Negro teachers and the abolition of Jim Crow laws. King still recalls the curtains that were used on the dining cars of trains to separate white from black. "I was very young when I had my first experience in sitting behind the curtain," he says. "I felt just as if a curtain had come down across my whole life. The insult of it I will never forget." On another occasion, he and his school teacher were riding a bus from Macon to Atlanta when the driver ordered them to give up their seats to white passengers. "When we didn't move right away, the driver started cursing us out and calling us black sons of bitches. I decided not to move at all, but my teacher pointed out that we must obey the law. So we got up and stood in the aisle the whole 90 miles to Atlanta. It was a night I'll never forget. I don't think I have ever been so deeply angry in my life." Twice before he was 13, King tried to commit suicide. Once his brother, A.D., accidentally knocked his grandmother unconscious when he slid down a banister. Martin thought she was dead and in despair, ran to a second floor window and jumped out, only to land unhurt. He did the same thing with the same result on the day his grandmother died. A bright student, he entered Atlanta's Negro Morehouse College at age 15. His father wanted him to study for the ministry. King thought he wanted medicine or the law. I had doubts that religion was intellectually respectable. I revolted against the emotionalism of Negro religion, the shouting and the stamping. I didn't understand it, and it embarrassed me. At Morehouse, King searched for some intellectual basis for a social philosophy. He read and reread Thoreau's essay, Civil Disobedience, and concluded that the ministry was the framework in which he could position his growing idea on social protest. At Crozer Theological Seminary in Chester, Pennsylvania, King built the underpinnings of his philosophy. A lecture on Gandhi transported him, sent him foraging insatiably into Gandhi's books. From my background, he says, I gained my regulating Christian ideals. From Gandhi, I learned my operational technique. The first big test of King's philosophy came in 1955, after he had married Coretta Scott and accepted the pastorate of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. On December 1st, 1955, a seamstress named Rosa Parks boarded a Montgomery bus and took a seat. As the bus picked up more passengers, the Negroes aboard rose on the driver's orders to give up their seats to white people. When he told Mrs. Parks to get up, she refused. I don't really know why I wouldn't move, she said later. There was no plot or plan at all. I was just tired from shopping. My feet hurt. She was arrested and fined $10. Within hours, the Negroes were embarked upon a boycott that almost ruined Montgomery's bus line. The boycott committee became the Montgomery Improvement Association, with Martin Luther King Jr. its president. King's home was bombed, and when his enraged people seemed ready to take to the streets in a riot of protest, he controlled them with his calm preaching of nonviolence. In less than a year, the Supreme Court upheld an earlier order forbidding Jim Crow, separate but equal, seating in Alabama buses. Montgomery was one of the first great battles won by the Negro in the South, and for a while everything seemed anticlimactic to King. When the sit-ins and freedom ride movements gained momentum, King's SCLC helped organize and support them. But King did not seem very efficient, and his apparent lack of imagination was to bring him to his lowest ebb in the Negro movement. By December 1961, King joined a mass protest demonstration in Albany, Georgia, was arrested, and dramatically declared that he would stay in jail in Albany until Albany consented to desegregate its public facilities. But just 2 days later, King was out on bail. The Albany movement collapsed, and King was bitterly criticized for helping to kill it. Looking back over it, he says, I'm sorry I was bailed out. I didn't understand at the time what was happening. We thought that the victory had been won. When we got out, we discovered it was all a hoax. We had lost a real opportunity to redo Albany, and we lost an initiative that we never regained. King also learned a lesson in Albany. We attacked the political power structure instead of the economic power structure, he says. You don't win against a political power structure where you don't have the votes, but you can win an economic power structure when you have the economic power to make the difference between a merchant's profit and loss. King began planning for his most massive assault on segregation. The target, Birmingham. King's lieutenant, Wyatt T. Walker, has explained the theory that governs King's planning. In quotes, we've got to have a crisis to bargain with. To take a moderate approach, hoping to get white help, does not work. They nail you to the cross, and it saps the enthusiasm of the followers. You've got to have a crisis, ending quotes. King went to Birmingham to conduct workshops and nonviolent techniques. He recruited 200 people who were willing to go to jail for the cause, carefully planned his strategy in 10 meetings with local Negro leaders, then declaring that Birmingham is the most thoroughly segregated big city in the U.S., he announced early in 1963 that he would lead demonstrations there until Pharaoh lets God's people go. Awaiting King in Birmingham was Public Safety Commissioner Theopolis Eugene, nicknamed Bull, Connor, a man who was to become a symbol of police brutality and who reflected the seething hatreds in a city where acts of violence were common. Connor was running for mayor against a relative moderate, Albert Boutwell. To avoid giving campaign fuel to Connor, King waited until after the April 2nd election before moving into Birmingham. Then King and his group began putting their plans to work. Connor, who had lost the election but refused to relinquish power, sent his spies into the Negro community. Fearing that their phones were tapped, King and his friends worked up a code. He became JFK, Ralph Abernathy, Dean Rusk, Birmingham preacher Fred Shuttlesworth, Bull, and Negro businessman John Drew, Pope John. Demonstrators were called baptismal candidates, and the whole operation was labeled Project C for confrontation. Day after day, Negro men, women, and children in their Sunday best paraded cheerfully downtown to be hauled off to jail for demonstrating. Connor arrested them at lunch counters and in the streets, wherever they gathered. Still they came. On May 7th, 2,500 Negroes poured out of church, surged through the police lines, and swarmed downtown. Connor ordered the fire hoses turned on. Armed with clubs, cops beat their way into the crowds. An armored car menacingly bulldozed the milling throngs. Fire hoses swept them down the streets. In all, more than 3,300 Negroes were jailed, including King. The Negroes had created their crisis, and Connor had made it a success. The civil rights movement, said President Kennedy in a meeting later with King, bull Connor as much as it owes Abraham Lincoln. The riots seared the front pages of the world press, outraged millions of people. Everywhere, King's presence was demanded. But while he preached nonviolence, violence spread. Freedom Walker William Moore was shot and killed in Alabama. Mississippi's NAACP leader Medgar Evers was assassinated outside his home. There was violence in Jackson, Mississippi, in Cambridge, Maryland, in Danville, Virginia. In Birmingham, later in the year, a church bombing killed four Negro Sunday school children, while two other youngsters were shot and killed the same day. Those events awakened long slumbering Negro resentments from which a fresh urgency drew strength. For the first time, a unanimity of purpose slammed into the Negro consciousness. Class lines began to shatter. Middle-class Negroes who were aspiring for acceptance by the white community suddenly found a point of identity with Negroes at the bottom of the economic heap. Many wealthy Negroes, once reluctant to join the fight, pitched in. Now sit-in campaigns and demonstrations erupted in every major city in the North and hundreds of new places in the South. Negroes demanded better job opportunities and end to the de facto school segregation that ghetto life had forced upon them. The NAACP's Roy Wilkins, a calm, cool civil rights leader, lost some of his calmness and coolness. In quotes, "My objectivity went out the window when I saw the picture of those cops sitting on that woman and holding her down by her throat." Wilkins promptly joined a street demonstration and got himself arrested. Many whites also began to participate, particularly the white clergy, which cast off its lethargy, tucked the scriptures under their arms, and marched to jails with Negroes whom they had never seen before. The Reverend Dr. Eugene Carson Blake, executive lead of the United Presbyterian Church in the USA, declared, in quotes, "Sometime or other, we are all going to have to stand and be on the receiving end of a fire hose." Blake joined two other clergymen in a protest march and was arrested. The revolt's basic and startling new assumption that the black man can read and understand the Constitution and can demand his equal rights without fear was not lost on Washington. President Kennedy, who had been in no great hurry to produce a civil rights bill, now moved swiftly. The Justice Department drew up a bill aimed particularly at voting rights, employment, and the end of segregation in public facilities. To cap the summer's great storm of protests, the Negro leaders sponsored the now famous March on Washington. It was a remarkable spectacle, one of disorganized order. some 200,000 strong, whites and blacks of all ages, walked from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial. There the Negro leaders spoke, Wilkins, A. Phillips, Randolph, Young, and Snicks Lewis. But it was King who most dramatically articulated the Negro's grievances, and it was he who would be remembered longest. King's seminal speech to the thousands gathered at the Lincoln Memorial and along the reflecting pool cried out for the freedom and equality long denied them. He ended with the words of a spiritual, in quotes, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." The march made irreversible all that had gone before that year, and Negroes made more gains than they had achieved in any year since the end of the Civil War. A speed up in school integration in the South brought 1,141 the number of desegregated school districts. In the North, cities re-examined de facto school segregation and set up plans to redress the balance. In 300 cities in the South, public facilities were integrated, and in some scores of cities across the nation, leaders established biracial committees as a start toward moving and resolving local inequities. New job opportunities opened as the nation. Businesses sent out calls for qualified Negro help, and finding a shortage began training programs for unskilled Negroes. Banks, supermarkets, hotels, and department stores upgraded Negro employees. In Philadelphia, Cleveland, and New York, pressure on the AFL-CIO construction unions, the most notorious Jim Crow organizations in the North, produced progress toward training of Negro apprentices. But for every tortuous inch gained, there are miles of progress left to be covered. There has been an inevitable lull, invisible civil rights activity since the March on Washington, and this has disheartened some Negroes. Says Richard L. Banks, Secretary of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Civil Rights in Massachusetts, "When the Negroes are not in the streets anymore, I'm awfully afraid that some of the people who responded will forget it. But the lull is deceptive. It is probably best described by James Baldwin." In quotes, "This lull is like a football huddle. People are reassessing. They are planning. We will flush the villain out." Close quote. Indeed, King's preparations for 1964 are well underway rather than continuing to target isolated acts of discrimination. As the movement has done in the past, King believes it is a time for an all-out attack on the entire system of segregation involving thousands of people. King's most intensive efforts will be centered on Alabama and Mississippi, where the problem and Negro suffering is greatest. King spends much of his time in airplanes, journeying to the far corners of the U.S. to speak to huge audiences. He traveled about 275,000 miles in 1963 and made more than 350 speeches. "Wherever he goes, the threat of death hovers. I just don't worry about things like this," he says. "If I did, I just couldn't get anything done." He had a gun in Montgomery but got rid of it. "I sat down with his wife Coretta one night and talked about it. I pointed out that as a leader of a nonviolent movement, I had no right to have a gun, so I got rid of it. The quality, not the longevity of one's life is what's important. If you are cut down in a movement that is designed to save the soul of a nation, then no other death could be more redemptive." And that article from Time Magazine, January 3rd, 1964, declaring Martin Luther King Jr. as Time's Man of the Year. And here are some recounts of folks that were at the March on Washington. "We were there," recalling the March on Washington, as told to Time Magazine in 2013 on the 50th anniversary of the event, written by Time Magazine writer Kate Pickard. Bob Zellner, Field Secretary, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, "The feeling was that after 1961 and 62, those really tremendous years of a lot of action, that March on Washington 63 was to bring the country to a realization that it has to not be a regional battle, it has to not be a young people's battle, it really has to be a moral crusade for the country." Hank Thomas, a freedom writer, said, "We did not see this as simply a civil rights issue. It was a human rights issue. We were saying to the world, this land of great opportunity, this land of liberty, has an asterisk beside it. It is a land of freedom for everybody else except black people." Harry Belafonte, who was there, singer and activist, wrote, "Many of us went off to World War II and didn't have the right to vote. Many of us went off to that war and didn't have the right to participate in the American dream. We didn't really think about this thing as a dream until Dr. King articulated it." Doris Derby, volunteer, student nonviolent coordinating committee, said, "Our committee met every week and we said, okay, what do we need to do to move this really large group of people from all over? We needed public relations. We needed to have a medical corps. We needed to have porta potties, arranged transportation. Once we had charter buses, regular buses coming in, what's going to happen to those? Where are people going to park?" Robert Avery on the March on Washington as a volunteer. "All of those signs that you see in the film clips, it was our job to staple them and put them together, then take them over to the parade grounds. We probably put together 10,000 or more signs. That morning, people started coming in, and those signs were gone in a few minutes." Nan Orrick, March on the Washington attendee, Georgia State Senator, "I was overwhelmed with the sense that I was in the presence of courage, the raw courage of young people to face police jailing you and beating you to the ground for the right to vote." Julian Bond, co-founder, student, nonviolent coordinating committee, said, "I was giving Coca-Colas to the movie stars, and I can remember till my dying day giving a Coca-Cola to Sammy Davis Jr., and he said, thanks, kid." Jerome Smith from Freedom Writer, "It was a ritual. It was a procession of church. It was never, ever a march. It was a congregation that was answering the call." Clarence P. Jones, speechwriter and counsel for King, said, "I'm standing on the platform about 50 feet behind him. Mahalia Jackson interrupted him. Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream." He takes the text of the speech that he was reading, and he moves it to the side of the lectern. And then he grabs both sides of the lectern, and I say to the person standing next to me, "These people don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church." And Rachel Robinson, the widow of Jackie Robinson, the founder of the Jackie Robinson Foundation, wrote, "We listened very carefully to the words as if they were almost like instructions. We all wanted to do something, and we wanted to have goals that we were going to work toward. We were looking for leadership, and he was offering it." Maxine Allen Johnson Wood, March on Washington attendee, "That I have a dream. To hear him give that message made you believe you did have a dream. A lot of people probably had not focused on those possibilities. We live in realities, but the image he gave was a future." John Lewis, chairman, student nonviolent coordinating committee, U.S. representative from Georgia, "President Kennedy was like a proud, beaming father that everything had gone so well. He said to each one of us as he shook our hand, 'You did a good job.' And when he got to Dr. King, he said, 'And you had a dream.'" Peter Yarrow, singer and artist from Peter, Paul, and Mary, mind you, wrote, "Ordinary human beings can gather together in large numbers, and if they gather together with heart and strength, they can change the course of history." And a couple of other notes about Martin Luther King Jr., the city that shaped him. As King grew up, his middle-class background offered some insulation from the brutalities of the Jim Crow system, but there were no guarantees. And the benchmark for moral leadership, casting aside his script, King reset every standard for his political oratory as his words conveyed a power and authority unmatched before or since. And a quote from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, "The presidency is not merely an administrative office. That's the least of it. It is preeminently a place of moral leadership." And John F. Kennedy seemed to understand that. Another quote, when he was at Selma, Alabama, "Let us march on segregated housing. Let us march on segregated schools. Let us march on poverty. Let us march on ballot boxes. until race baiters disappear from the political arena. And that was at the end of the March to Montgomery from March 25th, 1965. And as we know, he lost his life in 1968, the loss of a transformative life. 50 years after his assassination, King's dream of equality for all remains elusive. And finally, a quote from Martin Luther King that proved to be prophetic. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. That was Martin Luther King's last speech on April 3rd, 1968. I hope you've enjoyed this memory of Martin Luther King, the courage that he had in leading the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s in the United States of America. I'm Murray Everson, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
There's a man I think you've heard of. His name was Martin Luther King. Well, he wanted a world of peace and love. He said, I have a dream.